Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today, we take you to the Portland Masonic Temple for a talk entitled Getting Down to Business on Climate Action, a panel discussion with Senator Angus King. Joining Senator King on the panel today is Bob Perscasepe, Deputy Administrator of the U.S. EPA, David Littell from the Maine Public Utilities Commission, Charles Colgan, an economist at USM's Muskie School of Public Service, Alan Kuhneholm from PDT Architects, David Critchfield of Twin Rivers Paper, and Hallie Flint Gilman of First Wind. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and the program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing Senator King today is Charles Colgan.
Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Angus King is with us right now. I don't think he requires any introduction at all. It's been my pleasure to have worked with him during his time as the governor of the state of Maine, and subsequently to have him here today is really closing a circle for many of us who began this journey with Reggie, with Ned Sullivan and DEP, and many conversations many years ago. It is wonderful to have him with us today. I'm not going to waste any more of his time. Senator King, please join us. Thank you.
Yes. Well, first I want to talk about Maine's wonderful natural resources. Aroostook County, Mount Katahdin, Bar Harbor, the city of Portland, and Charlie Colgan. I was standing in the back listening to Charlie and leaned over to Alan Karen and said, you know, this guy is a natural resource for Maine and has been, and I really want to thank you, Charlie. To have somebody like him who has been an honest spokesman on these issues for so many years and has brought so many insights to us and gives us the data that allows us to make good policy decisions. It's a real, has been, you really contributed a great service. I do remember when I was first running for governor in 1994, Charlie and I were friends, and of course one of Charlie's best friends is Dick Berenger, who was also running that year. And Charlie actually had on his desk a Swiss flag to demonstrate his neutrality. This is a big deal. You know, I'm convinced that one of the problems that we have around here, not in Maine, but just generally, is we don't celebrate enough. You know, we're very good at identifying the problems, and there are a hell of a lot of problems. And, you know, I work in the U.S. Senate. I mean, that's a problem right there. But these rules that were announced this week are a huge step forward for the country. The most significant acknowledgement and doing something about the issue of climate change and fossil fuel use and the environment and the air in as long as I can remember, really. And it was really fun. I was doing a little research last night and found a great quote. It said, "These rules will bring an end to the automobile industry." Did you already tell them this? This is almost an exact quote. "Automobile production will end in the United States because of this rule." That was Lee Iacocca in 1971 when the Clean Air Act was passed. And there, you can go back and read all of these quotes from everybody who said, and I remember, I said, you know, one of my disadvantages is I'm old enough to remember those days and remember the total gloom and doom of, you know, it's going to cost, I mean, it's almost exactly what's being said today. It's going to cost thousands of jobs. It's going to close down. We're not going to be able to compete. It's, you know, it's impossible. Well, I'll tell you one, this is a great story about impossibility. As some of you may know, Chris didn't give me a long introduction. Sometimes people go through my whole resume, and I get up to the podium, and the only thing I can think is, this guy can't hold a job. Because I've had my 8 years as governor is the longest I've ever held one job in my life. But one of my jobs was as being the lobbyist for the environmental community in the 70s. I had the most interesting group of lobbying clients. I represented the environmental community, an organization called CRAC, the Coastal Resources Action Committee. Those, some of you remember that, Hottie Hildreth and Harry Richardson and others. I also represented that year the students of the University of Maine, the cable television industry, and the cosmetologists. So I always felt I really had a kind of broad base. But anyway, here's the story. One of the things that was accomplished during that period was the bottle bill. Okay? We passed the bottle bill. Now, most of you in this audience will not remember this, but when self-opening cans were first on the market, you had this circle that you pulled, and the thing came out, and it was like a razor blade. In fact, it's been immortalized by Jimmy Buffett in Margaritaville, where he talks about, blew out my flip-flops, stepped on a pop-top. For those young people, I'm now going to tell you what that line means. But you'd pull this thing out. It was sharp as hell, and, you know, it would get dropped, and it was bad for the environment. It was downright dangerous. And part of the bottle bill banned those things and said, it's got to stay attached to the can. And I remember vividly being on the third floor of the State House and having a lobbyist for the bottle industry, who shall remain nameless, Severin Beliveau. Severin came up to me, and he was very serious. You know how Severin can be. He was very serious and said, you know, Angus, we've really worked on this, and our engineers have worked on it, and we've had MIT look at it. It's impossible to make a pop top that doesn't remove. It's impossible. Well, here we are. I mean, the point is, and that's what's the best thing about what the EPA did, is they allowed the states and industry to have the creativity and the ingenuity to figure out how to get where we want to get. To me, that's the proper role for regulation, not for the EPA to say, you've got to put a scrubber number XYZ 42, you know, 46 feet in the pipe. No. Here's what we can tolerate out of the pipe. You figure out how to do it. And that allows the market to work. It allows ingenuity and creativity to work, and you end up with solutions that you didn't really think of, like dealing with cow farts in Wisconsin. Did I just say that? But this is a serious point. This is the way we should be regulating, in my view. Rather than prescription. I mean, the opposite example is Congress writing the formula for gasoline. You know, this gasoline shall have this percentage of this. That's not the way to do it. Technology and science are going to outpace it very quickly about the same time that you get the regulations written. And so this is a huge breakthrough. And I totally agree. I was so glad to hear Charlie say it, because I remember in you know, the late 90s, what I said was, the current environmental rules as they're being enforced are the worst of all worlds for Maine, because we're getting the bad air from the Midwest, and they're paying for the cheap power that makes us less competitive. That's a bad combination for us. Here's a great story about that. I'm sitting in the office one day, and I get this call. Ned left Maine and went to work for Scenic Hudson in New York, and I get this call from Maine. This is like 1999 or 2000, and Ned's breathless. Ned's always breathless. And Ned says, "You won't believe what happened last night." There was apparently a hearing somewhere in upstate New York on the construction of a new cement plant. And the air expert for the people that wanted to build the cement plant testified in the hearing. Somebody asked him about, you know, the stuff going up the stack and the smoke and particulates and pollution, and he said to the board, the New York Board of Environmental Protection, he said, "We don't have to really worry about what's coming out of the stack, because it's not going to get to the ground until it gets to Maine." So Ned called me that morning. That's a true story. And I immediately called Pataki and said, "This isn't going to work, you know. I don't think that plant ever got built." But that's what I'm talking about. And yet the other thing that makes it hard in Maine, and Charlie is right about energy rates, is many of the other areas of the country are federally subsidized. The TVA in the Southeast, of course, which is still a federal entity, an ind- independent but federal entity, is 30,000 megawatts. The TVA is as big as the whole New England power grid. And out west, of course, is the Bonneville Power Authority and the great projects of the Roosevelt era, Hoover Dam. Did you know that Roosevelt wouldn't let them name it Hoover Dam? I mean, political pettiness did not start last year. And they, you know, it was Boulder Dam for a while. And then, you know, it was Hoover's idea and concept, and finally it became Hoover Dam. But those were huge federal projects which amounted to subsidies of the energy costs of the peoples of those regions. We never had that. And that's why I was always sort of amused when people said, isn't it awful we're getting federal subsidies for wind power? I said, wait a minute, we're just getting what the other guys got 50 years ago. It just makes sense. But Charlie really said everything that needs saying. Global climate change is real. It's going to have significant economic effects. And I think in the long run, dealing with it is going to be, I know, dealing with it is going to be cheaper than not dealing with it. Just in terms of raw economics, just in terms of costs, and just in terms of things, you know, the infrastructure kinds of things, and the effects particularly on coastal states. As you know, probably the greatest champion on climate change in the Senate is Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. But I saw him the other day, and I said, I finally figured out why you're so passionate about this. He said, how come? I said, because you don't want your state to go away. You know, Rhode Island is one of the most vulnerable places. But I'm very positive about the way they've gone about this regulation and Maine is going to be in good shape. And by the way, don't let anybody tell you how draconian this was. The EPA actually made a decision that was hugely beneficial to emitters by using 2005 as the base year instead of 2012. We're already halfway, isn't it halfway, 15%? We're already close to halfway to the 30% goal. Already, it's in the bank by what's been done since 2005. So that was a big break, I think, for industry. So it's going to be a hell of a fight. I can tell you, in the Senate, it's going to be. I don't know whether it's what's going to happen between now and November, The traditional people who are opposed to regulation, who are opposed to President Obama, who are opposed to, you know, pretty much anything involving climate, you add to them coal state Democrats, and it's going to be close. And I can't predict the outcome. I think we'll be okay, but there's going to be a major battle between now and November to try to repeal these rules or delay them or otherwise remove the authority from the EPA to make these rules. It's going to be, I think, one of the major political, it's going to exceed Keystone, I think, over the next 3 or 4 months as an environmental issue. So you don't have to worry about me. I don't know where Susan is on this, but you also need to talk to people in other states. Now, I will say, one of my best friends in the Senate is Joe Manchin. Anybody know where Joe's from? West Virginia. Now, I think the administration did make a mistake, which could have helped to ameliorate the at least political and public impacts of this by, at the same time the rules were announced a significant investment in coal technology, which would have helped with people like Joe. Joe's position is, you know, I'm from a coal state. Coal is a huge part of the energy source of this country. Let's figure out how to do it better. We're not going to make coal go away. I mean, I hate to be the deliverer of that, but it's just too much a part of our energy base in the United States, not so much in New England. But so in addition to the rules that were just announced, I think there should be $1 billion or some amount of money invested in a kind of Manhattan project to try to clean up the emissions from coal. And I realize that many people say, no, we don't want to do coal at all. I think given the energy mix in the country today, that's a goal perhaps in some period of time. But in the meantime, let's try to lighten the impact. So that's the situation. I am optimistic about the rules. Let me also give you a little something for your argument kit. You're going to hear, this is Obama doing things by himself. By the way, here's the line. I was presiding the other day Are you impressed?
Don't be.
It's a chore for freshmen, but it's fun. And it's also pretty cool to be sitting there and have John McCain say, Mr. President. They call you Mr. President. But anyway, I was presiding, and it was, I think it was Tuesday, and it was a day many of the Republicans came to the floor to denounce the rules. Mitch McConnell, I can't remember a few others. The Obama energy tax. That's the phrase. I must have heard it 20 times in an hour. So clearly somebody's done some polling or something. That's the phrase that you're going to hear, the Obama energy tax. One thing you should know, and this is just a little fact because I get all of this mail in the office, about Obama and executive orders. You've heard this, right? The imperial presidency, Obama's bypassing Congress, doing everything by executive orders. Here's a really interesting fact. If you calculate executive orders issued per day, which is a reasonable way to compare apples to apples for presidents that had four-year terms and eight-year terms, Obama has issued fewer executive orders per day than any president since Grover Cleveland. Isn't that surprising? Doesn't that surprise you? You can go on, if you Google executive orders, you can find these charts, and the, you know, it's sort of a mountain. It starts in the late 1880s with Grover Cleveland, and it goes up and up and up, and, you know, Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, Nixon, and then Obama's way down here. So that's just sort of a sub mention. These are not his regulations. This is the regulations of the Environmental Protection Agency, based on the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court told them that they could do this, and then they did a study about the impacts and found that there were health impacts, and that put them in a situation where they're legally obligated to do it. The court said they have the opportunity and or the legal authority, and then the study which said there are, in fact, health and human effects, then that means they have to do it. And there's a fascinating article, I think it's in Politico, you can Google it, and you really ought to read it. Again, you ought to have this in your kit, by a guy named Leon Billings. It came out 2 days ago. And Leon Billings was Muskie's principal aide at the time of the writing of the Clean Air Act. And he talks about the provision 111D in the law, which is the legal authority for what the EPA just did, and how at the time they knew they didn't know everything about pollutants, but they left this opportunity for the EPA to regulate new pollutants that became apparent later. And here it is, later. And by the way, here's an amazing thing about the Clean Air Act. Astonishing. The Clean Air Act, one of the most important pieces of legislation in the 20th century, very controversial. Remember I said Lee Iacocca, everybody's going to put the whole world out of business. The Clean Air Act passed the United States Senate unanimously. Isn't that breathtaking? It tells you something about Muskie's leadership, but it also tells you something about then and now. Muskie spent years on hearings, hundreds of hours of hearings, hundreds of hours of markup, working with his colleagues. He got every single vote. And in the middle of the debate, Howard Baker, the Republican leader, gave his proxy to Muskie on some important votes. Can you imagine Mitch McConnell giving his proxy to Harry Reid or Barbara Boxer? But that, I mean, I think it does. It says two things. One is what an amazing guy Muskie was. But secondly, how far we've fallen in terms of our ability to get things done. And I can't not mention this firestorm, this great issue of the last few days about the young man coming home from Afghanistan. And, you know, there's a lot to discuss about that. But I got to say, I found it ironic that here's these guys who can't legislate, but they're very good at second-guessing the president. We're not doing our job, but I said on television yesterday, we've got 535 secretaries of state running around here. I'll just leave it at that. The rules are the right thing. I think they're going to be beneficial to Maine. Maine has I think 13% is our target. Vermont's is zero. But states that are less, you know, that are going to have to make some real changes, that's going to be tough. And it's going to be tough on them politically in this election year. Hopefully we're going to be able to get through this and come out on the other side with a set of creative solutions from across the country that are going to be good for the economy and certainly good for the environment. So thanks for having me, and I'm supposed to introduce the panel. But you can applaud.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank you for your record in championing the environment. I think that's very important to me. It's a very exciting time to be an architect right now in the state of Maine. Technology has come back to benefit us, and I couldn't agree more with Charlie and what others have said, that collaboration at all levels is absolutely critical to reducing our dependence and really becoming more energy efficient with our buildings. Buildings take a lot of our resources, both with electrical usage, our waste, the creation of materials, shipping them, and it's just huge, and it's underestimated. A number of years ago, when I first came to Maine, I came to Maine because of the quality of the air, and I think the quality of the air is right up there with lobsters. I would say that is our brand, and that's where we want to be. A huge portion of the stock of buildings in Maine were built prior to 1970, and as architects, we work on these buildings every day. They have no insulation. And we think the very first place to start is making our buildings the most energy efficient they can. So we, as architects, that's where we have to be. And I invite you to go to Architecture 2030 that was started by Edward Masria, the efforts of the American Institute of Architects, the Maine chapter of the American Institute of Architects. And I also want to put a plug in for the University of Maine system. We have our first School of Architecture. How important that is for us in the state of Maine. Another thing I want to mention, Portland Society for Architecture. We just had our waterfront visions this last fall, and we really wanted to get this dialogue about climate change as it relates to Portland and Commercial Street. A lot of our economy is generated from our coastline, and in Portland, Commercial Street is hugely valuable to us as a working waterfront. We want to maintain that. It's taken us a long time to get to this place. As you come in the front door, to the right, there are a number of boards that are laid out there on the table, and we commissioned a study that was done by folks from the Muskie School that showed what is the risk for us in the city of Portland in 2050 and also 2100 for a 100-year storm based on sea level rise information. And I invite you to take a look at that. It's a challenge for us, and it's something that we have to start talking about now, to come up with an adaption plan and not wait for a Sandy. There's also the Boston Resiliency Plan there as an example, but the Portland Society for Architecture has really tried to maintain this dialogue. And most recently, the Urban Land Institute was here, which was Portland and South Portland, that did a study on Commercial Street along with South Portland. That report should be coming out in about a month, and we look forward to that. And what's come out of that is two panels. One that is really going to look at the data regionally for us, and another panel that is going to make policy recommendations to our communities about how we should go about adaptation. So I would say, as architects, we are taking leadership, and it is critically important for all of us to think about conservation and think about our investments.
There we go. David Littell, the Maine Public Utilities Commission. Reggie, Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. This is a very informed crowd, but for anyone who was grabbed off the street and said, come on in, hear about market-based greenhouse gas control programs, and actually came in. The greenhouse gas program that we have is 9 northeastern and mid-Atlantic states, Maryland and Delaware up to Maine. We bound it together, actually starting in 2005. A letter from Governor Pataki, then Governor of New York, set it off. Majority of Republican governors at that time decided to move forward, along with Governor Baldacci in Maine, to set up the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. So the way that we run is that we auction off carbon allowances every quarter. We just finished our 24th auction and just announced $5.02 was a clearing price a few minutes ago. So 24 successful auctions. Very successful market. Our market monitor has never detected any evidence of market manipulation or of the market working incorrectly. Now, that said, one commodity analyst said, not the most exciting market, which is fine with us. We're not out to create excitement for commodity traders. Independent review was undertaken of just our first 3 years of operation. An expert group out of Boston called the Analysis Group was retained, set up a bipartisan group to oversee it, look at the study design. Some of the utilities were represented. We were not represented. They kept it away from us, which was frustrating at the time, until we saw the results. The results came out and said that just from the first 3 years of operation for how we dedicated our allowances, and this is on the economics, not on the pollution reduction, just the first 3 years of operation, they expected over the life of all those measures to create a net economic benefit for our RGGI states of $1.6 billion and over 16,000 job years created. So it works economically as well as an effective pollution reduction program. Next slide. Overall costs, by the way, if I mention, if you just look at costs isolated from those benefits that I cited, the costs are a little bit less than 1%, maybe 0.5% on average across all of our states. So there is a cost, but if you design the program well and moving forward, you can design the program so that your benefits will vastly exceed the cost. So how do we do that? Well, in New England, we've dedicated the largest percentage of all the RGGI states to energy efficiency. And in Maine, we just did not just that, but through the Efficiency Maine Trust, the director, Michael Stoddard, is here, who does the hard work in figuring out what programs to fund and what individual projects to allocate these monies to. Overall, about 40% of these revenues have gone to large-scale industrial and commercial projects. Why? That's where we can get the biggest bang for our buck in pollution reduction, in energy savings, and in reducing the bottom line for businesses to compete in the global marketplace to sell the products here in Maine. We're reducing their bottom line energy costs. Very important. Second largest share to the commercial energy projects overall. So about 70% of our proceeds are going to reduce bottom line expenditures for Maine businesses. And what does that do? Well, it reduces, obviously, their expenditures. It also creates macroeconomic benefits for the economy overall. So you get a double economic benefit. You're reducing the cost of doing business, you're keeping money in the region, and you're stopping the outflow of resources from the region to purchase fossil fuels that we don't produce in most of our states in the region. And then residential programs, 26%. So that's how we've allocated our revenues and how we make RGGI work. Next slide. These are overall benefits. Again, this is from the NRCM, who took a look at this most recently. If just the first 5 years of operation, about $31 million funded through the Efficiency Maine Trust, creating almost nine times that economic benefit over the lifetime of the measures. So that's sort of RGGI and how it's been working. It works so well, together with a lot of other measures, as well as straight market responses to the price of natural gas, that our cap that we set initially was a lot higher than actual emissions were. Emissions are down over 40% in the RGGI region since 2005 already. So we've achieved, through a variety of measures, over 40% reductions. Because of that, we looked at the cap and said the cap really isn't much of a cap anymore. So we, all nine states, all the governors, the legislatures, Maine legislature, decided to reduce the cap, to bring the cap down to current emissions. So we reduced the cap to half of what our emissions were in 2005. Going forward, this revision will not only reduce additional greenhouse gases, but it'll enhance those economic benefits that I talked about before. Our modeling shows that we'll get about $8 billion in gross domestic product for those states to be increased and generate over 124,000 job years. Now, an economist, I respect Dr. Colgan's opinion. Those, if you look at it from a macroeconomic perspective, they may be negligible, but it's a lot better that those gains are positive than negative, is all you can say as a regulator.
Thank you. First Wind is an independent renewable energy developer, owner, and operator, and our footprint is national. We have wind energy projects out west in Hawaii. We're constructing in Texas right now, and we have a big footprint here in the Northeast, especially Maine. We've also recently started to head into the solar energy space, which is very exciting for us. We have a project operating in Massachusetts and several more in the development pipeline. Our headquarters are in Boston, but I am lucky enough to be based here in the Portland, Maine office with about 20 colleagues, and we have about 20 more out at our projects around the state. The EPA rules from the First Wind perspective underscore what we really know as a company from experience, which is that converting, developing new renewable energy resources is the most cost-effective, fastest way to reduce our carbon emissions. So we're very excited about the rules, and we're very excited about the flexibility that the rules have built in so that different states and different regions can work out solutions that work for them. We obviously do a lot of business in the Northeast and in the Reggie states. Even within that footprint, each state has a slightly different approach. So that flexibility, from our perspective, is critically important. One of the best parts about working in the wind energy industry is the moment like this, where I get to talk about the benefits. So I've brought my security blanket, so I try not to forget any of them. There are a lot. Our experience in Maine has been fantastic. Industry-wide, about $2.5 billion have been invested in wind in the state of Maine. And if you look at the projects that are in the pipelines and have been announced, there are $3 to $5 billion of investment ready to go in the next 5 years or so. So there is a lot of economic activity that we get to talk about. The dollars from these projects flow through Maine, in particular, in really three different ways. There are community benefits, direct community benefits. There are property tax benefits. And then there are construction and supply chain type benefits. So I'll talk about each of those briefly. The Maine law requires certain community benefits on a sort of per turbine basis for these projects. And it's a minimum. These community benefits are kind of locally designed, so they are targeted to fit the sort of particular requirements and interests and needs of the host communities where these projects are located. And these are not token benefits. We have a project, Bingham, 186 megawatts, that's in the permitting phase. The community benefits associated with that project will be about $7 million a year, which in that region can have a really large impact. The property taxes are similarly substantial when you look at these projects and can make a really big difference. Our communities have been able to repair roads and invest in other infrastructure projects by improving their staffing at the town level and address a lot of kind of critical investments that would not have been particularly possible without the investment of the wind industry in their area. Again, looking at sort of the Bingham as an example, the property tax impact is expected to be about $2.1 million a year for that project. In some ways, though, the best part of the story is the construction and supply chain part of the story. Using the Bingham example, it's about $145 million of spending in those areas, and about $35 million of that is in wages, is how that sort of trickles down. And in our experience in Maine, our company has worked with about, when we last checked, over 300 companies across the state, all sizes of companies, all kinds of companies, every county in the state. And so people have really kind of developed an expertise in this area. People have found niches. There are all kinds of great stories. People who have developed tiny shops where they have invested in specialized equipment for washing turbine components, which is a key part of the construction process. Turns out the garden hose doesn't end up doing the task. So companies spring up to address particular needs related to these projects. And then, in some ways, the most exciting part is these companies have an expertise that they can export to wind development in other states or other regions, or to new parts of the economy, like offshore wind, or even in the first one case, like the solar space. So this supply chain, this level of expertise that we've been able to develop in Maine, there are many of you in the room, as I look around, who can speak to it from a personal point of view, is really a huge part of the story about what this whole policy shift, what it has meant for Maine to be out in front on renewable energy. So the economic benefits are substantial. There are also energy benefits, which are changing so rapidly that I wanted to point to them. Wind energy, largely driven by developments in the wind technology itself, has become incredibly competitive. And I just want to make sure we underscore that point. The cost of wind energy has come down since 2009, like 42%. The change is staggering. And what we have seen in study after study done by places like the state of Massachusetts when they're considering whether to do procurement of new renewable resources, they are concluding that for every, for instance, in this recent procurement, for every megawatt of new wind that they contract for, they estimate that their customers, their ratepayers, are saving $1 million for every megawatt. I mean, these savings are substantial over the lives of these contracts. So that story has changed tremendously recently, and it's a huge opportunity and another way that this region and the state has been way out in front on this issue. It's very exciting to see. And of course, finally, there are the environmental benefits. Again, using Bingham as the model, the carbon emissions expected to be saved annually from that project are 228,000 tons. So for the environmentalists in the room, that might mean something very concrete. For some of the rest of us, it just sounds like a whole lot of carbon. But in, again, studies, one study commissioned by the Maine Public Utilities Commission to look at the economic impacts, London Economics ended up fixing a dollar amount on those carbon savings and actually concluded that the carbon, the sort of environmental benefits, were really about twice what the property tax impact was. So these are significant savings, and discussion about the sort of property risks, infrastructure risks, health risks associated with carbon emissions. There's a lot of interesting work out there that has really tried to fix the sort of economic impact of those numbers. So we are, as so many have talked about, we are in a region that has been way out in front, and the results are powerful. So we are excited to see what these EPA rules can mean for areas that are looking for their own ways to solve these environmental challenges.
Hi, good morning. I'm David Critchfield. I'm sort of standing in here for actually a very strong team up at Twin Rivers, and in some ways also sitting here for Maine Pulp and Paper as well. Twin Rivers, as some of you may know, was Fraser Paper at a time. They went into bankruptcy. Brookfield Asset Management acquired them. We, in this past year, stood back in front for Brookfield, and I think the Atlas team and Blue Wolf saw what many of you in the room also know about Maine. I mean, it's about people. And you can look at assets like this anywhere in the country, and they'll all look just about the same. But in the case of this operation, and I should say that Twin Rivers really is more complex than actually just Madawaska. Really, Twin Rivers represents a pulping capacity in Canada and the paper mills in Madawaska and a sawmill also in Canada. We don't take second seat to anybody on presidential permits either, because there's actually a presidential permit in place in Maine to make sure we can convey pulp, steam, white water back and forth across the St. John's River. So as I say, I'm sitting here for Tim Lowe, Phil Nadeau, a very strong engineering team who, it wouldn't be right to say fortunate, they were disciplined enough back in the 2010-11 era to put several very sturdy proposals together and match up with an equally sturdy organization, Efficiency Maine, and earn two awards. And these will just be sort of example giving in some ways, because this is Efficiency Maine gave out some of this REGI funds, and we think put it to very good work. Two, just to use an example, and as Hallie said, I won't bore us all with numbers. I was specifically forbidden to talk about cavitation in control valves when I talk about one of the projects, so I'll jump past that four-hour lecture. We implemented what's called variable frequency drives, 37 of those, which to the tune of about $600,000, and that without getting into horsepowers and hectares, that ends up basically dropping about 3,000 tons a year of CO2 equivalents out of the mill budget. When I asked Phil, so about how many more of these projects do you think you've got online? And he said 172. I said, don't you mean kind of like about 170 or 150? No, no, I have 172. So this is the kind of engineering discipline that Twin Rivers and certainly other Maine pulp and paper engineering teams bring to this effort. The other project was kind of an interesting thing about pulp and paper or steel or whatever industry category you want to think about it as, and this is sort of the citizen on the street doesn't quite get this until we get to a blackboard. Luckily, we don't have a blackboard, or I'd go to it. Is some of these things come and sort of think of it as lumps. I mean, the other project was a significant drop in steam demand, and that meant figuring out amongst these 172 projects, if you will, the next generation, how many of them do we need to get together into one bundle so that we can drop steam demand in the Madawaska side by 40,000 pounds per hour? If we could only drop it by 30,000 pounds per hour, we ended up still having to run a boiler on the Madawaska side, still having to use oil. And so we couldn't take that boiler offline. So the team was able to sort of, with a lot of work, and it was these are young men and women that I'm extremely impressed with. I spent part of my career with International Paper, and we had massive corporate resources, engineering divisions located in Mobile and Cincinnati, and they were dedicated to servicing a group of mills. Well, this is a team of people right there in the Madawaska facility, which is, to me, it's like a remarkable thing about Mainers. They don't sort of say, where's corporate headquarters? They get right down to work. They found a way to pull 40,000 pounds an hour of steam demand out of the Madawaska mill during the winter months, which is not an easy thing to do, and that enabled us to basically offset approximately, I think it's like 11,000 tons per year of CO2 demand, generation capacity. So pretty extraordinary work. As I say, Phil and the team have got 172 more projects that they have got to do the sort of the next bit of bundling. It's not just like throwing it all up in the air and hoping Efficiency Maine gives you that grant. You've really got to figure out how you get projects that earn their payback, if you will. The other thing, again, without drifting into a blackboard discussion, is Maine mills face kind of an interesting dilemma when it comes to capital expenditure, and this is why REGI and Efficiency Maine are so important here, is you can think about capital expenditure as kind of as almost like three buckets. There is the bucket that is in the front row, and that is the bucket that helps you make your product better, helps you stay competitive worldwide, helps you make it run more efficiently. The second bucket is the energy efficiency buckets. It's where you really can make the mill energy budget more efficient compared to your competition. The third bucket is sort of all the, none of the above. It's everything else. Unfortunately, because of the way the world pulp and paper markets have been, we usually have filled up that first bucket, and there's not a lot left for the second bucket. So really, capital that's available to the mill has to, they can match that 50-50, but it's always going to be a fight. So that's sort of a way of thinking about how an industrial operation thinks about their life. They've got these buckets to juggle capital in, and there's just capital is short. That's all there is to it. I can't match Senator King story for story by any means, but I have one interesting story, and this is sort of a example of how, again, Mainers and the Atlas Blue Wolf team thought alike in this regard, was the minute the transaction closed, Atlas sort of likes to throw into the room kind of an exploding balloon. They say, what would you guys really like to do to figure out how to do things better at this operation? And one of the good sharp engineers who's been working on odor control actually on the Canadian side, that's where the pulp mill is, that's where the odor is potentially. This is a sulfite mill. It's not the same as a craft pulping mill. Said, we need to find out how to do better. We need to see what the competition's doing. So this kind of relates back to coal a little bit, because we took a trip in the beginning of this year, first quarter, to several mills in Europe. European mills are very open. They don't like you to take pictures, but they're happy for you to wander around the mill as much as you want. And we went to three mills, two in Austria, one in the Czech Republic. And the one in the Czech Republic story and one of the Austrian mills is the one, I guess I'll just leave you with this and turn over the microphone. It was stunning in this regard in that we went to the Czech Republic mill, obviously it's former behind the Iron Curtain. So you were in a very, very disciplined place. They would not let you even take out a camera. And it had the mill was what I would consider, I've been in the paper industry since 1982. It was, I picture it as like a Soviet era showcase mill. I mean, I've never seen a front office or a tidier operation in my life. But that wasn't the remarkable part. The remarkable part was the mill manager looked us in the eye in the introductory meetings and said, I want you to, when you look at operations, I want you to tell me what you think is missing. And when we got to the back end of the site visit, one of my colleagues said, so how are you powering your boilers? He said, well, they're natural gas. And he said, when did you put that in? He said, well, that was that happened by demand or edict at the government level. We were using coal, up until December of last year, and that site you see out there was a coal pile. It's gone. We switched over in 2013. No questions answered, no questions asked. It had to happen. So the Grotcorn mill went from sort of 60 miles an hour to a standing stop and changed gears that fast, which just was remarkable to us. Second and last sort of anecdote that really made our team sort of sit back and think we've got things we can do differently is one of the Austrian mills was in a little town called Lensing, and this was also a sulfite mill. They make something called dissolving pulp, which we won't go to the blackboard on that either. They ran a waste treatment plant, and I'm an environmental professional all my life, as he said, that had the annual operating cost to run this plant and generate treated effluent of $16 million per year. So this Austrian mill is spending approximately $16 million per year to treat its effluent. Our entire waste treatment system in Madawaska and Edmondson combined does not capitalize out at $16 million a year. It was sort of remarkable the discipline they had about how they would sort of squeeze everything out of the effluent. They were actually generating usable product from their effluent. And it showed our team that there are miles to go, but they are achievable. And we're going to head in that direction. Thanks.
I've been to that mill, and it's one of the great mills in Maine. And it's, of course, the unique thing is it is in two countries. There's a pipe that crosses the river. And it's always fun to visit Canada. I don't know do you know the definition of a Canadian? A Canadian is an unarmed North American with health insurance. David and Bob, I wanted to ask you, it seems so obvious sitting here in the wake of the new EPA rules, and is Reggie a model for the country? And are other people talking and learning and from what, I mean, it's been, your graphs are stunning.
EPA, my understanding is allowing us the option, us being all the states, of adopting a Reggie-type model. First of all, if any states are interested in joining Reggie, we're happy to speak with them. I think we sort of let the politics play out in D.C., some lawsuits before we see how some states are going to move forward. But we do have encouraging sort of informal conversations with many other states. We certainly think it works. It's shown that you can have economic benefits and achieve cost effectiveness by creating a large market and achieving the cost reductions, the greenhouse gas reductions.
Could other states join the existing Reggie, or do they have to start their own?
They could. We're open for membership, but I think having heard from some of my colleagues elsewhere in the country, they think that it might be more politically palatable to do their own regional version of Reggie. And in that case, we helped California set up their system. California is now up and running very strongly, and we're happy to provide whatever technical assistance to any states in describing how Reggie works, invite them to join. And it's certainly a potential model that they could use.
Bob, your thoughts?
Well, the section of the Clean Air Act that you mentioned that Leon Billings wrote about, the former staff person for Senator Muskie, was written to set up states doing plans. But we see no prohibition in that of allowing states to join with other states when they do their plans. And I'm being at a very high level. So this enabled us, with that interpretation, to make it clear in the rule that places where states have joined up, the individual state plans could be the aggregate of those. And so we think that the success of Reggie has helped us visualize that, not to mention the fact that the administrator was involved with it when she was in Connecticut. But it might have had some impact, I'm not sure. But the other one is that other states are talking to each other. There are conversations going on, even in the Western Governors Association, about how they might do it. And you know, we're going to end up probably having to look at, can pieces of state plans be interstate versus all of them? And so we're going to be open to a lot of comment on that. We think it is a really important approach to take. We didn't think we could mandate it, you know, but we could keep the door open for it. And I think that's probably the right place along the lines you were saying, how you do regulations. We want to make sure that people can do it. I think as time goes on, even after we start implementing it, perhaps that states will begin to see some of the efficacy of joining together with their partners or in different parts. The other thing that's going to be pretty important is looking at the way electricity moves around the United States and how energy conservation and energy efficiency work. Where does the credit go in the state planning process? If we have electricity going from one state to another, being generated in one state, going to another state, and that state invests in energy efficiency, where is the credit, even though the emissions reductions are in another state? So there's going to be an inevitable interconnectedness here that is going to continue to be apparent. So our role right now, as you have mentioned, is in our proposal, is to make sure everybody knows that this is something that can be done, and we've tried to write how it can be done, and we'll learn more from the comments. But I think it is a really important strategy, and I think Reggie has been a leader. The Northeast states have been a leader in the country in showing how it can really be an effective tool.
Let me ask a final question to Alan. You mentioned our old housing stock. I think Maine has the oldest housing stock in the country. Does this mean that a continuing obligation, if you will, or at least opportunity for all of us is reinvestment in winterization? And are new buildings being built to a higher standard generally?
Absolutely. It has to be on all fronts. It used to be that we'd do a brick building and that was it, and you would pump the oil into it, and because we had plenty of oil and it was cheap. But we now have buildings that are costing $5 per square foot for utility costs, and we're able to achieve under $1 a square foot. And these are site utility costs. So I think there's a lot of efforts to be made there, and having a level playing field, especially when it comes to an energy code, because you have to do both. I don't think it's fair to take credits to subsidize if we're not doing as much as we can in our own backyard, and we're very good at that, and I think we need to broaden the base and make it a level playing field.
I will identify, and I'm sure I know David is well aware of this, a looming issue, which is transmission of energy, both electrical and natural gas. There is a very serious problem of pipeline capacity into New England. We sit right next to the Marcellus, but we can't get the gas. And last winter, there was a huge spike in price from $5 to $100 for a period of time, which is going to reflect itself in bills. By the way, here's another prediction. Electric bills are going to go up in the next 6 to 8 months. People are going to blame these regulations, even though they haven't. But they're going up because of the transmission problem of natural gas. And as wind is developed in Maine, there's transmission problems of getting that wind power out of Maine. So those are issues that we've got to be thinking about. And you may say, well, we don't want more natural gas. Well, the alternative, if we can't get enough natural gas to provide our electricity, is going to be to run Cousins Island more. There's no free lunch in this business. Everything has consequences. But the shortage that we had last winter, I met just this week with the head of ISO New England, and the shortage last winter was we were close to the edge in terms of generating capacity. So I throw that out, Lisa. That's an issue that, we all have to think about is the regulation of the development of infrastructure. So
I want to say something about the transmission because I think that's a really important question and observation. And others will have some, obviously, some thoughts about this. But when we built this flexible rule, we've been talking a lot about the states and the plans and can states join together. But inside what the states would have to do are four basic building blocks. One is making the existing plants more efficient. We can do to power plants what we've done to automobile engines and turning them into the electronics that have made automobile engines more efficient even as we use them today compared to what they were in the 1960s. And some of that kind of automatic technology, smart blowers and things of this nature can make power plants more efficient and can squeeze another 6 to 9%, depending on the plant, out of those plants. So that's the building block number one. Make the stuff you have that's generating electricity as efficient as it could be. The second building block is we have excess capacity of natural gas, and we don't use wind that we have built already all the time. So the idea is to move the electrons from that capacity to where it's needed more efficiently. So I don't know the exact number. Maybe we use the existing natural gas capacity in the country somewhere around 60%. Perhaps maybe it's a little less or a little bit more. I'm not exactly sure on the exact, so don't quote me on the number. But our rule says, well, let's move it to 70%. Now, somebody may say, let's move it to 80%. You know, but in order to do this, people who have to put the capital together to build the transmission lines are going to, and who have the product that they want to move to the place where the capacity is, Senator, they're going to see this signal as a way that the capital markets are going to start looking at those investments in pipelines differently, is our aspiration. And so the third building block is more low or zero emitting sources like renewables or nuclear and certain approaches that we're looking into on biomass. So the idea there is sending a signal to the investment in the renewable portfolios that many states have already adopted. And then the fourth building block is one we've spent a little bit of time talking about here today, and that is the energy efficiency component of it. How do you take your existing utilization of these electrons and be as efficient as you possibly can be? Huge capacity to improve that in our country. So what we did is we looked at those four building blocks and we applied them to the state based on the conditions that are in the state. And that's why you see some differentials in around the country and why inherently the REGI states get to take advantage of what they've already done, because when we apply those four things and they've already done some of it, the differential is a little bit different. So that is what we really did here. And so where you start counting from, whether it's 2005 or 2012, I'm not going to say it doesn't matter, but we used 2005 to talk about this a little in many ways because of the international discussions. We've committed as a country to get 17% from 2005 by 2020. This rule, along with the automobile rule and other trends in the economy, are going to get us to 17% by 2020. What now is going to be negotiated is what are we going to do by 2030? That's what's going to happen at the Paris meetings next year, and so we show that. And so the other last point I'll make about investing in this transmission, both electric lines and pipelines, is we're trying to provide a timeline here that will provide the ability for states to look at how and capital markets to look at the investment. This isn't something that, and this may disappoint some, that is going to get implemented in 3 years. It's going to take some time to make these transitions, and we want to provide the space for the investments that's needed. I'm going to stop there.
Great.
But these are really important questions, and it's important to understand that trying to take them into account has been an amazing three-dimensional chess game in trying to create a flexible rule. And some others may want to talk about
Isn't it nice to have regulators that are as smart and perceptive as Bob? I want to thank our panel not only for what they did for us this morning, but for what they do in their daily lives.
That's right.
For the architecture and the renewable energy, the work at the mill, the work in the regulatory agency, and the work at the PUC. By the way, did you know that the day after these regulations were announced, China announced that they're going to put a cap on carbon? That's a big deal. And that's the answer to the critics who say, well, it doesn't matter what we do here in the United States because nobody else, you know, we've got China and India. The only way we can get them to move is if we show a little leadership ourselves. And I think this is exactly where we are. So, thank you, Lisa. And one last word is I think it's wonderful to have the Natural Resources Council and the Chamber working together. That's such a good message, and it says something great about the state of Maine. Thank you all so much, and wonderful to be with
you.
Big
hands for everybody here.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Today's program was a panel discussion led by Senator Angus King entitled Getting Down to Business on Climate Action. The panel discussion was recently held at the Portland Masonic Temple, and if you missed part of the program, you can listen to it again on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Jonathan Woodward.